Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week we'll be talking with Jean Morgan Moe, whose new book is In Pursuit of Alaska. And for Mother's Day, we'll visit with mother-daughter writers Diane de las Casas and kid chef Eliana. Jean Morgan Moe is a family practice lawyer in Covington, Louisiana, but like many writers, that's her day job. She also has some great stories to tell about the 14 years from 1971 to 1985 that she lived in Alaska as a young wife and mother and newspaper reporter. While she was there, she began a book, and after putting it aside for a long time, she finally finished it. Today, we'll be talking about that very book, In Pursuit of Alaska, an anthology of travelers' tales from 1879 to 1909. Hi, Jean.
Hi, Susan.
Welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
So what took you to Alaska in the first place?
Well, I was married to a man who got a job in Alaska, and we went. We were young. We had one young child and another on the way, and we went to live up there.
It's quite an adventure.
It was.
Well, you began reading these stories while you were living there. You were a newspaper reporter while you were there, right?
Freelancer.
Freelancer. And you began reading traveler's tales and working on this book. What captivated you about these stories?
Well, I was taking writing classes at the University of Alaska, and one of my favorite professors suggested that I run up to the library and take a look at the rare book collection because I think he thought I might find something up there that I liked. And indeed, I did. The first book I pulled off the shelf was a book that's included in the collection called The Shameless Diary of an Explorer. It's by a New York journalist named Robert Dunn. And Dunn was an incredible person. He was really different. He was from Newport, Rhode Island, born into a family that was so upper crust that they asked to be taken out of the social registry because it included upstarts named Vanderbilt.
Oh.
And Dunn was working in New York for a muckraker named Lincoln Steffens. Mm-hmm. And Steffens told him about an expedition that was being put together to try to climb Mount McKinley. And that's Dunn's book. And I read it, and I fell in love with it. And then I started pulling these other books off the shelves, and I couldn't believe it. Here were these absolutely incredible stories written by these fascinating people who were going to a place that I loved in a very special time.
So they went for such an amazing variety of reasons. That's what struck me reading these stories. Talk about those.
Well, some were missionaries. There's a priest and a young lady who was, I think, 28, who went to Alaska when she had a baby and went to live among the Chilkat Indians and spoke none of their language. They spoke none of her language. And her husband would go off at night and leave her alone. And she'd sit in her house and sew with the Indians staring in the window. I thought she had an enormous amount of courage. Of course, lots of people went for the gold rush years, and that was quite exciting. And there's some gold miners in there. As one of my writers, Addison Powell, says, they went in pairs, one to hold the sack, the other to shovel in the gold. And they went to climb mountains. There was a real pushback against mechanization and urbanization. And people who had the funds and the time to travel saw Alaska as a place where they could be first to do something. There was a great push to try to climb mountains. And actually, several of these people are from England. There are six of the people in the book were British citizens who wanted to be able to do that thing. One of them traveling with his manservant, Harding.
Mm-hmm. And some were sent by the government, right?
Some were sent by the government. There's a wonderful writer named Josiah Spur who did one of the first U.S. geological surveys in the Yukon River Valley and is said to have established the fact that there was this gold belt that ran along through the middle of Alaska. And Spur had wonderful adventures. You know, you had to carry everything that you needed when you went out into the wilderness in Alaska. Spur was traveling in places that were known, but some of the people were traveling cross-country in places they didn't know. But Spur went to the various gold mining camps and met with miners and said that they were so erudite that they had books of philosophy, books of science, and that's how they got through the winter. They took Shakespeare and acted out the parts. as they sat around the fire in the winter.
Now, I think that would make a great novel.
Isn't that fun? Isn't
Shakespeare that in the mining community, you know, locked in the winter months.
Great idea. I love it.
And some of them just went to say they'd gone, right? Mm-hmm. Excursions.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I especially loved some of the women in this book. That's one of the things that struck me, that you had to be very brave. Mm-hmm. A very brave woman to go off to Alaska then, although we know lots of women go off to Alaska now for other reasons. But tell us about some of the women. Septima Collis, say.
Oh, Septima Collis was fascinating. She lived on Fifth Avenue in New York, had read everything she could about Alaska and wanted to see it. And her husband was a Civil War general named Charles Henry Tucky Collis. And General Collis suggested to his wife that rather than summer, as she usually did at Saratoga Springs, that she run up to Alaska for the summer.
Run up. I love it.
She travels cross-country on a train, stops at Yosemite, as they often did. If they traveled across Canada, they'd stop in Banff. She stops in Yosemite, tours around Yosemite. They take carriage rides and so forth. Gets to Tacoma, gets on a ship. And, you know, part of what made travel to Alaska so difficult in those days was that it was arduous. Her ship glided along at the rate of 15 miles an hour. Can you imagine?
Oh, wow.
So you're going 1,000 miles at the rate of 15 miles an hour. She said everything was in apple pie order on the ship. It was electrically lit from stem to stern. Her room was too small, so she quickly complained and was given larger quarters with a separate room for her suitcases. But she loved Alaska. She said the visit to Muir Glacier was the great event of her life, although she did say that one should either bring along one's hobnail boots or stay on the ship and gaze at the perfection from afar because the climb to the top was so arduous.
And then there were those two. I love these two. Mary Hitchcock and Edith Van Buren, who took everything they might, you know, have needed for almost anything, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. They took china, silver, linens, silk gowns. Mary Hitchcock went up the Yukon to Dawson, playing her zither and mandolin along the way. They had an ice cream freezer with them. They had a portable bowling alley. They took the equipment for a movie theater because they were going to make lots of money in Dawson. One of the historians says that they were the only two going upriver that summer who were on a lark.
And yet, sadly, a lot of these dreams did not pan out for people.
Mm-hmm. This is true.
You know, and some of them ended up in incredible poverty.
Right.
And what about M. Clark, who dressed as a man? And
oh, isn't she fascinating?
Yes.
M. Clark was a great delight because she never reveals in her book that she's a man or a woman. You can read between the lines and tell that it's a woman. But there was always for me this mystery about M. Clark. And when I was writing the book, I thought, you know, with the resources that are on the internet these days, I was able to find out a lot about the people that I didn't know before. And I was searching M. Clark, M. Clark, M. Clark, and I found online M. Clark's granddaughter, who's now 90. I actually met the woman. Last year I was in Seattle and I went to meet this woman. Just a real character. And she and the great-grandson told me the stories about the grandmother and what had happened and how she'd gone. And she had these little children with her and she went. Her claim was stolen, so she started dressing as a man and carried a gun and adopted the name of M. Clark.
She was amazing. Just amazing. Now, what of yourself? What point of connection did you feel with all these people as you were reading? What were you looking for?
Good voices, good stories, that note of authenticity. But it really was a story. There was one writer in particular who was in the original draft, and he's pretty important in Alaska history. And I kept saying, Fred, give me a story. Just give me a story.
I know
he didn't have a story, and I actually substituted someone else for him because the story wasn't good. So.
And then you have these fantastic photographs that bring that whole period to life so richly. They're just lovely. Now, how did you pick those out?
Well, when I was originally looking at the photographs back in the 80s, they were all on microfilm. So I was straining my eyes over a lot of microfilm and found lovely, lovely photographs and wanted photographs that captured travelers, people, so that you could see their faces. And there are a lot of those people that you can look at and see their eyes. In fact, I show those pictures to people. And one guy told me in Alaska last summer, he said, I know that guy. I know that guy in the picture, which was really fun. But nowadays, Alaska has digitalized photographs and documents from all over the state, and they're available online. And so there's a treasure trove of incredible photographs and maps that you can research, and you plug in actresses, and it comes up with these wonderful pictures of women being carried across a river by men on their backs.
Wow.
Good stuff.
And that's from the digital archive that she found.
That's from Alaska's digital archives, yes.
Amazing.
It's lovely. Yeah, it's really great. I understand that we have something like that in Louisiana, too.
We do, and it's fantastic.
That's great. You know?
So tell us why you concentrated on this particular period in Alaska's history.
Actually, that was dictated by the writers, because the writers that I was really attracted to had all been in Alaska between 1879 and 1909. I'm now finding another cache of them that's in another period, but that period, so much happened in Alaska during that period. John Muir went. He started writing about Alaska. No one knew anything about Alaska. Nobody really cared to go. And Muir wrote this series of articles that were so well received that commercial operators said, tours. We'll start offering tours. So the tourists started going. And then there were rich people who had the means and the time and who went up there to do all these things that no one had ever done. People like journalists, missionaries, things like that. And then, of course, the years of the gold rush.
Oh, yeah.
So that happened, that it was this 30-year period when these wonderfully exciting things had happened. And those were when my writers had gone.
So have you been back yourself?
Yes.
How often have you been?
I go every time I get a chance. And I'm now married to a man who loves it. And so we go and we have fun. We hike. We do.
Oh.
Yeah, lots of fun things. And one of the fascinating things about Alaska is it doesn't take a great deal of effort to get away and be someplace by yourself. Robert Dunn, the writer that I tell you that I'm so enchanted with, used to say he loved to feel like he was the only person on earth. And you can do that in a place like Denali Park. But you can also do it in a place like a trail above Valdez. My favorite hiking trail is one where I don't see any people or any bears. And Jerry and I hiked a reconstructed trail above Valdez that was, again, built originally in 1899 by William Abercrombie, who's in the book. And the trail is in some places so steep that the people who built the trail had to hack at the bushes with one hand while they held onto brush with the other so they wouldn't fall off. We saw probably about 6 piles of bear scat. And once you get out on a trail and you start to see scat, you don't quite know what to do. Shall you turn around? Is the bear behind you or is he up ahead somewhere? So we just kept going. It was great.
Wow.
It was great.
I'm glad you didn't see a bear, although I think I would kind of like to see a bear from a distance.
The blacks are fine. You don't want to see a brown from a distance.
Yeah. All right. Good to know if I ever make it to
find a black. Try not to see a brown, right?
Oh, well, we've been talking with Jean Morgan Moe, whose terrific new anthology is In Pursuit of Alaska, an anthology of traveler's tales, 1879 to 1909. She'll be signing her book Thursday, May 9th at 5:30 at Garden District Bookshop. Thanks so much, Jean.
It's been a delight. Thank you.
Big Sam left Seattle in the year of 92 with George Pratt, his partner, and brother Billy, too. They crossed the Yukon River and found the Bonanza Gold below that old white mountain just a little southeast of Nome, where the river is winding. Big nuggets they're finding. North to Alaska, they're going north. The rush is on. Way up north
to Alaska.
Way up north
to Alaska.
North to Alaska, they're going north. The rush is on.
My two guests today are a dynamic duo of mother-daughter writers, Diane de las Casas and her daughter, kid chef Eliana Marisol Casas. Diane is the author of many, many books for children, and her most recent is The Little Red Hen. That's red, R-E-A-D. And Eliana's first book, which is just out, is Cool Kids Cook Louisiana. Welcome to The Reading Life, you two.
Thank you. It's such a pleasure to be here.
Thank you.
Now, Diane, your new book, The Little Red Hen, is all about how to do a good job in writing, isn't it?
You know, the idea came about because every time I would go do school visits, all the children would ask me, how do you write a story? What are the steps for writing a story? So I kept thinking about it. I want to do a book about writing a story about writing a story, and how can I frame it in such a way that children will understand? So I took the traditional folk tale of the little red hen, where she usually bakes bread, and this time she makes a story, and none of her friends will help her. So she goes through all the steps of writing a story: brainstorming, researching, outlining, drafting, editing, and proofing.
And it's a wonderful breakdown. It truly is. So I think it's going to go over well and be very helpful in classrooms. You've taken it around to schools already, haven't you?
Yes, I have. I actually, in January, I did a writing residency based around the book in South Louisiana, down in the Thibodaux area. And the teachers loved it. And teachers give you the thumbs up, you know, that's good. And the students, they were so enthralled with it. And one of the students commented on my blog post. You know, I blog every day when I'm at a school. And one of the students said, "Oh, Miss Diane, you made us much better writers. I'm going to remember the writing process." So that, nice. I think, is the biggest reward.
It is. Now, Eliana, I have to ask you a question. Have you read all your mother's books? I have to ask that.
Of course, but but not read them. She tells them to me.
Oh.
Way, way, way before they come out.
And when did it first dawn on you that your mom was a writer?
Oh, ever since I was a baby. Always telling me stories.
And what made you realize that you could be a writer, too? Because you're awfully young.
Well, you know, she used to do the summer reading programs, and I would tour with her around Louisiana. So I would go up on stage or whatever and, you know, do everything with her. So one time we did, my first tour was a hula tour. She was teaching all the kids how to dance hula. And I knew it. She taught me how because I just wanted to learn it. So I learned it, and I stood up on tables, and I would dance the hula. So I was always in front of crowds.
A four-year-old hula dancer. That's pretty impressive. So when did you realize you wanted to write your own book?
Well, you know, I was chosen as one of 13 Latinos in the New Orleans area to be featured at a museum exhibit at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum here in New Orleans. And I thought that would be a great time to debut my first cookbook. So we knew way in ahead, and we were like, we have to get this finished before we go to the exhibit for my cooking demonstration and book signing. So I got my cookbook finished, and I wrote all of the recipes after it was done, and we got the books, and we were like, oh my gosh, this is awesome.
I think cookbooks are kind of hard to write because you have to do all that, you know, break it down,
right,
do it step by step, and then you test all your recipes, obviously.
I do. Every single recipe I test. And that's actually my second cookbook. The first one is Eliana Cooks Recipes for Creative
Oh,
Kids.
That's right. I'm sorry. I forgot that one.
That's
of course.
Okay.
And I have that one at home.
So I have both of them, and the first one is the one that I debuted at the museum exhibit.
Mm-hmm. And your sister did the illustrations for this book.
For the second cookbook, and the first cookbook, she did all the illustrations. So she did all of my cute little kid chef characters in my cookbook. She did all of the formatting and layout. So she did all of the illustrated.
It's a family affair.
I've been to your house. I know it is.
Three girls and then my husband, the one sole gentleman in the house.
It is the house of wonderful food and good times, though.
And lots of books. We always have lots of books all over the house. We're constantly collecting books. I mean, she, of course, is inspired by cookbooks and cooking magazines and that sort of thing. She's also a voracious reader. She reads a lot of young adult novels, and it's hard to, you know, to see how she finds time for everything, because not only does she do the cookbooks, but she also has her own radio show, and she writes every single week. She produces two of her own segments and produces all of the content, so she's doing all the research.
It's hard to write. It takes a lot of time. So what books do you like to read? Who are some of your favorite authors?
Ooh, some of my favorite. Well, right now, I'm actually in the middle of a trilogy. It's by Lauren Oliver, the Delirium Trilogy.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm on the second book. It's called Pandemonium. So I'm actually almost finished. I have like a couple of pages left, so I'm really excited.
Yesterday she was reading in the car, and all of a sudden she started clapping and making this gleeful face, and I was like, what is going on over there? She's like pointing to her book like, oh my gosh, look what's happening. Like, I don't know.
So do you like series books? A lot of people do.
I do. I do like series books. I do.
I like knowing the story is going to go on for a little longer than usual, you know. So this is reading you do for pleasure. Not not for work, not for school. What cookbooks do you like? What are your favorite cookbooks to read?
Well, I usually look at lots of cookbooks to, you know, inspire writing my other recipes. So I like to look at things that I'm working on. So my next cookbook is going to be Cool Kids Cook, Fresh and Fit. So I'm looking kind of more of the healthier recipes. And I'm actually trying to grow a garden. So we're looking at, you know, books with gardening.
And like that gardening book you just bought.
I did. I just bought a gardening book. So I'm kind of trying to read the garden books.
And you came to that wonderful opening of the library in Algiers and made pesto out of your own garden.
Oh, I did. Yes,
it was fantastic. So
that garden was destroyed by the hailstorm.
I know.
So we have to start all over again. But it's kind of fun, you know, to start over
and plan a new one.
Yeah.
So you're awfully young to have settled on a life path. But I want to ask you, do you think you always want to write cookbooks? Do you think you might ever like to write another kind of book?
I don't really think I really like cookbooks. You know, I'm not a big, like, just to write fiction. And like, I just nonfiction cookbooks is my writing recipes.
We were talking about, I have this chapter book series that I'm working on. I can't say too much about it, but it involves cooking, and Eliana is going to develop the recipes for it.
But again, it's only the recipes.
But she's going to be consulting with me on it because, you know, she's got the mind of a child. She can connect with her peers. And, you know, it's always good to be connected with kids when you're writing a kid's book.
Mm-hmm. So how do you two share books as a mother and daughter now? Do you read some of the same ones?
I just passed on to her Michael Ruhlman's The Making of a Chef. So she's in the middle of that. She's kind of a schizophrenic reader. She reads a bunch of different things.
I'll read like books for school, books for pleasure, books for my chef career. Like, I don't know.
She does. She reads a lot. So,
I love to hear that.
We truly lived the reading life at home.
I know you do. I've seen those books. You live the reading life and the cooking life, which is really great. And you have so many family stories about books and food. And to bring Soleil in to do the illustrations, that's a really wonderful thing.
Yeah, she's in Baton Rouge today. She actually just landed a job with a graphic design firm, so she's really excited and got that call on the way here.
Oh, congratulations. Well, the book is so bright and cheerful. Both of them are just so great. So
thank you.
I hope you're going to have a happy Mother's Day. What are you going to do for Mother's Day? Will you be cooking, Eliana?
Nope.
We are actually being featured at the Roosevelt Hotel for their brunch. So they're doing a Mother's Day special with featuring the mother-daughter team. And so we'll be signing books and probably speaking a little bit.
Very cool.
Yeah, and they're treating us to brunch.
Yes, so I don't have to cook.
Well, you deserve a day off like everybody else. Well, rock on, you two. You're great writers and you're great cooks, I know. And happy Mother's Day.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. We've been talking with the amazing Diane de las Casas, whose most recent book is The Little Red Hen, and her daughter, Kid Chef Eliana, whose second cookbook is Cool Kids Cook Louisiana. Thanks a lot, you two.
Thank you
so much.
M is for the million things she gave me. O means that she's only growing old. T is for the tears she shed to save me. H is for her heart of purest gold. E is for her eyes of lovely kindness. R is for the right she'll always be. Put them all together, they spell Mother, the word that means the world to me. The word that means the world to me.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Aaron Greenwald signs A Company Man, The Remarkable French Atlantic Voyage of a Clerk for the Company of the Indies, a memoir by Marc-Antoine Caillot, Tuesday, May 7th at 5:30 at Garden District Bookshop. The First Tuesday Book Club discusses The Lion is In by Delia Ephron, Tuesday, May 7th at 5:45 at Maple Street Bookshop on Maple. Winona Hodder signs Foodopoly, The Battle Over the Future of Food and Farming in America, Tuesday, May 7th at 6 at Octavia Books. N.S. Patrick discusses and signs The Mysteries of Jack the Ripper, Tuesday, May 7th at 6 at the Old Metairie Branch Library. Novelist Rachel Kushner reads from The Flamethrowers, Tuesday, May 7th at 7 at the Columns Hotel. That's part of the 1718 reading series sponsored by Loyola, Tulane, and University of New Orleans students. She also appears with novelist Nathaniel Rich, author of Odds Against Tomorrow, Thursday, May 9th at 7 at Press Street Headquarters, 3718 St. Claude Avenue. Today's guest, Jean Morgan Moe, discusses and signs In Pursuit of Alaska, an anthology of travelers' tales 1879 to 1909. She'll also present a slideshow Thursday, May 9th at 5:30 at Garden District Bookshop. Sarah Carr discusses and signs Hope Against Hope, Three Schools, One City, and the Struggle to Educate America's Children, Thursday, May 9th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Roger Kamenetz discusses What I Learned About Judaism from the Dalai Lama, Thursday, May 9th at 7 at Temple Sinai, 6227 St. Charles Avenue. Chris Champagne and Brian Spitzfaden read from their work, Thursday, May 9th at 8 at the Goldmine Saloon. That's part of the 17 Poets Literary and Performance Series. Rebecca Amberley signs The Itsy Bitsy Spider, Saturday, May 11th at 11 a.m. at Octavia Books. And don't miss Forestival, a celebration of art and nature at a studio in the woods, Saturday, May 11th from 11 a.m. to 5, with food and music and tours and art activities. A studio in the woods provides residencies for artists and writers to work in its lovely natural setting. For more information, check out astudiointhewoods.org. Jackson Galaxy signs Cat Daddy, What the World's Most Incorrigible Cat Taught Me About Life, Love, and Coming Clean, Saturday, May 11th at 2 p.m. at Garden District Bookshop. The Octavia Books Science Fiction Book Club discusses John Crowley's Little Big, Sunday, May 12th at 10:30 at Octavia Books. Eli Hastings reads from and signs Clearly Now the Rain, A Memoir of Love and Other Trips, followed by an open mic, Sunday, May 12th at 3 at the Maple Leaf Bar. Julia Reed signs But Mama Always Put Vodka in Her Sangria, Adventures in Eating, Drinking, and Making Merry, Monday, May 13th at 5:30 at Garden District Bookshop. Frederick Barton signs Black and White on the Rocks, Tuesday, May 14th at 5:30 at Garden District Bookshop. And Bill Lofelm signs The Devil in Her Way, Tuesday, May 14th at 6:30 at Maple Street Bookshop in the New Orleans Healing Center. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading. Thank you.